with the police banging on the door. Open up.
The choice to be in that lineup was the last choice I made as a free man.
A year later, I ended up right in the system.
I'm going to be one of those people who everyone in the world is going to think is a monster or suspect is a monster for the rest of my life, and I'm just going to have to come to peace with that.
Somebody was able to look at my picture in a database and say that I was somewhere where I definitely wasn't.
I overheard three of the jailers discussing what part they might have to play in my hanging. They had been told that two prison officers would have to participate in my execution.
And I walked back inside that prison for the last time, man. All hell broke loose, man.
Welcome to another episode of Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Today we have a very incredible person as our guest. Our featured exoneree today is Frankie Carrillo.
Carrillo was 16 in 1991. 15 sheriff's deputies with guns drawn stormed through the front door. Carrillo was convicted of murder and sentenced to two consecutive life terms.
Frankie was released from jail in downtown L.A. this afternoon after spending 20 years in prison.
Carrillo was released after the court found evidence that Carrillo was framed through coerced testimony for a fatal drive-by shooting. The gang of corrupt L.A. sheriff's deputies, known as the Linwood Vikings, coerced six witnesses into identifying him in a photo lineup.
Frankie, welcome.
Jason, it's good to be here.
So, Frankie, your story begins when you were really just a child.
I was a baby, man.
Let's go back to the beginning. You grew up in L.A., right?
That's correct.
Southern California. And you had a pretty happy upbringing, right?
Yeah, I would say that, yeah.
Everything was going along more or less okay. Nothing's easy about being a 16-year-old boy.
That's right.
Then one day...
it all was turned upside down. That day was January 24th, 1991. I was just a little color there. I was a high school student. I was the child of a divorced family, four siblings. My father had raised us since the age of nine. So it was a very male-dominated household, dad and two boys. It was what I'd known for the past 7 years.
And right, and you had a sort of a unique situation, too, which is that your mom had one day just decided to check out.
That's
right?
It, yep.
It wasn't like they got separated and you spent half the time with her, or she just left.
That was it, yeah. I mean, it's an unfortunate story, but that's what happened.
Yeah, so you had been abandoned in a very real way and experienced something that's obviously going to affect any young man for the rest of his life, but that wasn't the worst of what was to come by far. And again, 16 is really, you're not a child, but you're closer to a child than an adult at 16.
Right. Even though it was my age, I was 16, psychologically, you're still a kid, and you know, maybe operating at 13, 14 level, not to, you know, minimize it, but I'm a boy, I'm a kid.
What were you in, 10th grade?
10th grader.
10th grade, exactly. That's what I'm saying. 10th grade, you're closer to middle school than you are to college. So.
You know, and I hadn't even shaved, so it's like a good reference is that you're at the point where like facial hair is sort of developing, but you're not there yet, Frankie. Like, hold off, right?
And then one night, 15 cops bust in your house. What a surreal situation. You were asleep?
I was asleep.
Just a normal night?
Yeah. It was early morning, so it was dark, but it was 6 in the morning when this happened. And my father and I went home, and they couldn't get in. They were pounding away, and ultimately, I opened the door, looked out the window, knew it was them. They were screaming who they were, and they stormed in, ordered my father and I to the floor, and that's the beginning of the nightmare, really.
So they ordered you to the floor. Did they tell you what was going on?
I wish they did. You know, it was pretty strategic and in all business, so they wanted to, like, ransack the home was their main objective. And, you know, my father and I, really my dad was trying to exert his position. This is my home. What are you doing here? And he was being ignored. So he's telling me, like, what's happening? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I have no idea why they're here. Soon after, on the ride to the sheriff's station, is when I learned that I had been accused and ultimately now being arrested for a murder I hadn't committed.
So you get to the sheriff's station, and what happens next?
Really, I was expecting my father to show up. But what happened was I was placed into an interrogation room. The people who showed up instead were these two sort of cowboy detectives ready to play the good cop, bad cop on me. And I played along. You know, they said what they were arresting me for and if I was willing to talk. And I said, sure, I'll talk. Like, I have nothing to hide. Like,
right. And so you waived your Miranda rights.
I did.
And that's such a crazy thing, Frankie, because I think it's hard for most people to understand why someone would waive their Miranda rights when you have the right to a lawyer. who would want to give that up? But the fact is, in your case, I think it's fairly typical, which is that if you're innocent, and this is an ironic thing, right? If you're innocent, a lot of people go in, they think, well, why do I need a lawyer? I'm just going to answer some questions and the justice system is going to work because I'm an innocent person who abides by the law. And then they'll see that they made a mistake and then they'll go catch the real guy.
Exactly.
Right. Unfortunately, it's going to take stories like yours to help educate people so that they don't do that. You do not give up any information without getting a lawyer.
But I will add, Jason, that when you're in that cold room, and the power imbalance is obvious. You are in a detention facility, basically. You're in their stronghold. You're in the sheriff's department's space. And you're there as a visitor. You're there, obviously, being charged for this crime. In my case, being wrongfully charged. And so, to some degree, as a young boy, you want, these are adults. I'm looking at these men. And you want to cooperate. You want to, like, yeah, I'll talk to you. I have nothing to hide. It's sort of my position. Looking back now, obviously, I wish there was a civics class that would have said, you know what, no matter what, innocent, guilty, whatever the situation is, just wait for your parents or wait for a lawyer.
Yes, it's a tragic twist or irony that when you're innocent and you go into the situation, you're more likely to waive your Miranda rights than if you're guilty.
Exactly.
In that interrogation room, how long were you interrogated for? Do you even know?
You know, surprisingly, I think back of that 5-10 minute interrogation, and I sort of left that room thinking, you know, where was the lamp? You know, where were these guys punching on me? Like, you know, you watch enough TV to understand that this is supposed to unfold a little bit differently than it did, in my case at least. They were very quick to just say, there's a young boy who witnessed a crime, who was adamant that you were the guy who did it, so we got you. And let's talk about you just confessing to it. So it was really very brief, very precise on their end. And I think I might have chuckled, not to be silly here, but it was just like so unreal. Like, one, are you sure you're talking to me? I'm adamant that it wasn't me, obviously. And their position was like, we're beyond if you did it or not. We just want you to just come clean, just confess that you did it. And I was like, what? I can't do that.
It ended after 10 minutes?
That's it. Like, they weren't trying to press me or starve me out, anything. They were just like, okay, we'll see you in court. Like, we're going to jail now. Like, that was it.
Hearing that, and that's an unusual interrogation in that it went on for such a short period of time, it sounds to me like at that point they actually did think they had the right guy because they were like, okay, well, this guy's not going to give it up, but we got the right guy, so it's okay. We're gonna get him no matter what. But as things unraveled, they took steps that were corrupt and illegal. How did they end up managing to convict you when you were so obviously not the guy?
So, you know, in Los Angeles, at least, there's a very familiar story about misconduct with the LAPD. So Rampart Division scandal, it's more readily available knowledge, but my case didn't involve LAPD, it involved the LA Sheriff's Department. And there's a well-known, at least locally, of the Linwood Vikings. So Linwood is where this crime happened and where my arrest was ultimately investigated. And the Linwood Vikings had become a rogue police gang. So what I thought as a naive boy, that I was dealing with law enforcement who were abiding by the Constitution and their policies in the department, some of the people on this investigation team were these bad cops. Sort of fast forwarding here of information I knew, not at the time, but as the case developed. And so when this young boy who was used to identify me, who was shown a photo lineup, a photo six pack to ultimately say this is the guy who committed the crime, the case sounded pretty cut and dry. There's a witness, was shown a photographic lineup. He quickly identified the shooter. We got an arrest. Slam dunk. And so there was a trial and I was tried as an adult and it moved forward to a conviction. But at some point, it was discovered that this young boy wasn't as innocent as, you know, he was more than just a witness. It was revealed that he was an informant for one specific law enforcement officer, Deputy Ditch. And so Deputy Ditch? Deputy, of all things,
oh my God.
Deputy Ditch, right? I mean, what a name, right? Craig Ditch is the guy's name. He's now retired. The guy had this boy under his wing as an informant, and he happened to be at this crime scene. And so it was very, very easy to say, I'm your go-to guy here. So the story later was discovered that this young boy was shown photographs after he'd been interviewed 5 times by other investigators with no results. They realized Ditch had a relationship with this boy. Ditch shows up. Case is over. The case was solved once Ditch arrived in less than 8 hours. And the story that was revealed that the young boy was shown the photographs as what was in the report. And so he picks a random picture just to play along. And Ditch says, that's the wrong guy. He's in jail right now. Try again. you know, I'm sure he's feeling like an idiot at this point. You know, you're trying to help. You're young. You're scared. So he picks another photograph, and the deputy says, this guy's dead. What about this guy here? We think he's trying to come up in the rankings or whatever. And so the boy just says, yeah, I guess that makes sense. I guess that's the guy. And this
Wait, he was looking at six photographs.
Yep.
He was 0 for 2.
Exactly.
He picked very badly. He picked a guy who was in jail and a guy who was dead.
Right.
That's, yeah, really hard to make a case against those guys.
Right.
And
right.
By the way, it's sort of odd that there was a guy in the six-pack who was dead.
Give me a break, like, right?
What, I mean, you would think they would take that guy out.
Let me jump in here and say, well, you know, Frankie, what's up? You're coming off as this high school student, nice guy. What's your photograph doing in the sheriff's department? Like, tell us about that. I'm sure that was your next question, right?
I'm getting to that.
What happened in this environment? This is 1991 is what we're referencing here. That specific sheriff's department's policy was that if there was anyone that you thought was a potential bad kid or bad guy or bad anything, let's do some racial profiling at this point, right? Let's gather intel. And so the photograph was obtained in the summer between my sixth grade and seventh grade vacation block there. Me and some of my buddies just ran our BMX bikes through a local park. No big deal, summertime. And this deputy Luna, remember the guy's name, sort of just rolls up next to us. It's not an official lights on, pull over. He stops, we stop, start talking about who has a girlfriend and where do you live and what's up with you, whatever, right? Just pretty cool, talking to a cop, no big deal. Then the guy says, do you mind if I take your photograph to the group? I don't remember us looking around saying, what do you think, guys? We just like, I guess, like you're a cop, right? Like, what do we say, no? And so this is the time when you had Polaroid cameras. So the guy got out of his car, went into the trunk and pulled out the little manual Polaroid camera. And one by one, he just came to right where we were on our bike standing and just snapped a photograph. And so that photograph that was taken in a park with trees in the background and whatever else was in the background, I was smiling in my picture. That photograph ended up in the six pack. So talk about like a chain of events here that fucks your life up, right?
Oh my God. I mean, that's really the most, I've heard all types of different stories. And you're right. That is a question that people often ask. Why was this picture? Now, what we know is that if you live in a poor neighborhood, specifically a poor minority neighborhood, the cops do sweeps and they'll pick up everybody, right? So your picture could be in there because you had a joint or any other thing. It could be in there because you were trespassing, right? I have air quotes under that one, or whatever. And so it's really true that a lot of people have records for the most minor misdemeanors. In your case, you had no record whatsoever. Actually, it was probably, I mean, thinking back to when I was in sixth or seventh grade, if a cop would have asked to take my picture, I would have felt good.
Right.
I've been like, wow, this guy wants to take my picture. I'm a pretty cool kid. So your picture was in the lineup because this cop had, in a sneaky way, racially profiled you as a 13-year-old boy riding his bike in the park, which is exactly, as far as I can tell, what 13-year-old boys are supposed to be doing. You were identified in this insane process, right? Which is literally like, it would be funny, except the results are so tragic.
Right.
So he eventually managed to come up with the answer that the cop wanted, which he could have saved himself the trouble by just saying initially to the kid, hey, this is the guy we want. Identify him. That would have been simpler.
Exactly.
It would have saved 5 minutes.
Right.
So you're identified. You go to trial.
Well, I'm tried as an adult. I'm going to keep harping on this, but I'm a kid. So there's a process here in California that determines if you're worthy of juvenile court or you have to go with the big boys, right? And so this was a murder, and they felt that it deserved a higher punishment. And so ultimately I went to trial. I had an assigned attorney that the county, who wasn't a public defender, it was like a panel attorney. I have to say this part here is that when I walked into the courtroom and I was chained to, you know, the chain gang there, everyone's there being arraigned, all adults, and everyone's looking at me like, what did you do? Like, steal some candy and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they're just ragging on me, these adults who had obviously been there before. And so I'm the last guy to be arraigned. And so everyone's freaking out like, oh, shit, we weren't expecting that charge for this kid, right? And prior to that, I will say that, and it kind of goes to just me being so naive here, is that I heard someone call my name. And I'm like, I'm so little. I'm like raising my hand like I'm over here. And I looked over and I saw this good-looking white man with this amazing suit on, this like tan suit, walking towards me with a file. And I was like, oh my God, they've assigned me the best fucker in the room, man. Like, this is all going to be worked out. Like, this is it. I got the Barry Sheck of the world. Sadly, it's just an example of like where my mentality was. Even my perception of this new world, this courtroom was like, sadly, like a white guy coming to your rescue had like such an impact from living in a society where the majority of people around you are people who look like you and who, you know, other than the teacher or whatever. And so I thought it was a little sort of funny looking back at that moment, getting me so excited about everything's going to be okay now, right? Obviously not.
Obviously not. I mean, the odds were stacked against you. The government was willing to lie to get the conviction. They were willing to use an incentivized witness, and they convicted you.
They did.
And now you get sent to maximum security prison.
At the time, they had a juvenile facility, so it was like the youth authority for young adults. So I went there, and the sentence was 30 years to life with an additional 6 life sentences attached to that. So I'll say that when I heard those words come out of the judge's mouth, I couldn't imagine or perceive like a week or a few months in my life. To now to imagine 30 years to life plus life, I couldn't even comprehend that. For someone who wants to be sort of funny and sort of mess with me, it meant like do 30 years to life, die, and then you're back in prison. Like even if you ever come back, right? And it was like...
You mean like if you get reincarnated?
I suppose, right? Like you're back, they're sending you up for your next life.
It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And none of this makes any sense, but that in particular doesn't make any sense just in terms of the semantics of it. It's interesting too, right? Because there was a witness who actually wanted to come forward and who had information that could have prevented you from being convicted in the first place. Is that
there
right?
Was. So he wasn't just a witness. This guy that you're referring to was the actual killer. So as a bizarre twist in this case, the investigator had discovered who the murderer was. And
Was this your investigator or their investigator?
It's a bizarre twist to all this. And it's not to minimize the bad police work here, but now it's also bad defense work here. My defense attorney had an investigator who had went out and become the world's best investigator by tracking down who actually committed the crime. Turns out he knew the murderer. And so there was this conflict of interest of either get off the case or reveal that this is the guy who did it. He had this young man, the actual murderer, confess to the crime. There was a 6-page confession that he took from this man. And what he tried to do, to his credit, he tried to convince this guy to come to the court and just say, look, Frankie didn't do it. It was me. And he arrived with an attorney. You would assume that the judge would say, well, wait a minute here. Before Frankie goes down and he's sentenced, let's hear about this guy in the hallway. And lo and behold, the judge says, you're too late. You've been convicted by a jury. All this sort of like last minute information that's apparently in the hallway, just deal with it in your appeal.
So after the jury renders you guilty and the guy's standing outside the doors of the courtroom.
Exactly.
Who's actually holding the cards to your freedom.
Well, I mean, it would have shed light if someone cared about truth, right? It would have been like, well, let's bring this guy in. And so it failed me even again at that point.
That's such a crazy
thing,
right?
It's a bizarre twist, man.
You were like 30 feet from freedom, sort of, right?
Right.
If the doors would have opened and this guy would have been allowed to walk in, and provided he actually came clean.
True.
Because he might have changed his mind. People do that. But you had a real opportunity to avoid this most nightmarish fate that anybody can possibly imagine. But that's not what happened. And ultimately, there were 6 witnesses who testified against you.
That's true.
The crazy thing is, they all recanted, right? Eventually, they all recanted.
They initially used this one boy, this 15-year-old boy, to arrest me based on this photographic lineup. And so 6 months, which is bizarre here, everyone was under 18, so everyone was very young. 6 months, maybe even 7 months after the crime had occurred, for the first time, the other 5 boys had been shown the photographic lineup. And we all know about memory, and there's been studies, and it's been proven that this is not a recording that you have on your phone. In your mind, memory is recorded a little bit differently. It's like little snapshots, and as time goes on, they fade, and other information filters in, and it gets very tainted. So it's hard to really recall, especially a drive-by shooting, the middle of the night, you hear gunfire, you're ducking, you're running. So to really capture that, it's like an immediate on-the-scene interview is like the best one. So we're talking about 7 months later now, where these boys are showing photographs for the first time ever.
Wow.
And sure enough, one by one, they say, yep, that's the guy. It's photograph number 1. And it was obviously later determined that this young boy, the 15-year-old boy, made it a point to tell everyone else, if they ever show you photographs, believe me, I know who did it. It was photograph number 1. And so now we got 6 people, right?
And it's so absurd to think that 7 months later, as you said, in the middle of the night, in the dark, in a drive-by shooting, that all the factors are there for almost a guarantee of wrongful identification, exactly. Misidentification, and that's exactly what happened. So you spent much more than half your life behind bars.
Right.
You're only a cognizant human,
right?
Maybe for 10 years, let's call it, or a round number. So more than twice that amount of time, you're now in a cage in a violent, scary, hostile environment. How did you manage to make it through that?
You know, well, when I think back about how I survived 20 years of incarceration, what I remembered most about something my dad said sort of in passing or just sort of give me some advice at the dinner table, which was, if there's adults around, go to them. He's sort of instilling these things about just society. They'll help you. And so I think here I am in a room full of adults. I'm in an adult court, and I'm expecting everyone to do the right thing just because you're an adult. I'm a kid. You're supposed to be watching out for the system and yourself and everyone in the room. And so that went haywire. That failed me. But I think that this very fuzzy idea of humanity was being born. And so I arrived in a place that was very sad. I mean, it's dangerous when you hear about it from the outside, but from the inside, it's a very somber and just sad place where people are being confined. And so I'm talking to you from the ground level here, other people who don't want to be there, and they're also suffering on whatever level. And you join in on this pity party about life, you know? And so first couple of years of that, you know, you're trying to sort of find your place. It's a social dynamic there. And so you're moving in groups of your kind and, you know, you get a job and you kind of get active in what's happening there. But luckily for me, and I really thank my dad for saying that, is instilling this idea that whoever they are, but people are good people. And in my case, I had to be careful with who I told that I was innocent, because, you know, that's back to the sort of ranking about, like, you're a murderer in prison has more status than if you were there for child molestation. And so even in my environment, I think innocent is probably below child molester.
Wow.
Like, you don't even belong here. Like, what the fuck, man? Like, you're not even a criminal? Like, we're all tough here. So I learned that. I made a mistake and told the wrong guy that I was innocent. And the look he gave me was like, oh, shit, maybe I shouldn't be telling people that I'm not like you, right? Obviously, like everyone else, I read and I feel like I'm like a natural chameleon. So I just adapted to my environment. I've always been very diplomatic. So I was always trying to be the peacekeeper. And so that helped. The pain and also like the hope was that like somewhere, somehow, someone was going to realize that this was a huge mistake. And so the system that failed me, the criminal justice system that failed me, and everyone who makes that sort of term, happen and work the way it's supposed to work, I suppose, I was expecting them to figure it out and help me. It's sort of like suspending reality and thinking, forget what just happened to you or you've been wrongfully convicted, and try to hold on to the one piece that these people can do the right thing. And so I'm expecting people to do the right thing.
It's incredible that you would be expecting people to do the right thing when, with the exception of your father, everybody who was supposed to have protected you either abandoned you or turned on you in the most vicious way.
Right.
And yet you maintained this outlook like, if I just be me and be honest and be optimistic, then eventually people are going to accept me for who I am, which is an innocent guy trapped in a sentence that doesn't belong to me.
Right.
That's really, there's a lot to be learned from that, right? Because all of us go through little disappointments on a daily basis, right? Or a weekly basis or whatever.
Yeah.
And so many people react to those. And certainly being around you and the other exonerees, I always say it puts gratitude in my attitude, you know? And I learned to be, I think, much more understanding of life's little twists and turns, because they all seem so trivial when you deal with someone who's been through hell.
Right.
And managed to maintain, well, not just sanity, but a sense of grace and kindness and optimism.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
But
you know,
I'm going to add also, Jason, that there was something happening that I didn't realize this until many years later, but we're all conditioned in a way. And specifically, when we think of prison, we think of the ugliest human from his behavior, what he did, or the way he looks, and the tattoos, and what ponytail, whatever we have in our minds etched out as like what a prisoner looks like. And so imagine a guy who's great looking as I am in a prison. You might think, oh man, this guy's vulnerable to like sexual assaults, right?
Yeah.
But the reality is that, pull perversion out of it, you're in a place where you're almost like a porcelain figurine in a bar. And it's almost like people want to protect you and they're curious about, like, what's this guy with no tattoos doing amongst us? Why is he still nice? Like, you know, we're all mean and talking shit to each other. And this guy's like talking about good morning and whatever, right? And so I learned that my humanity hadn't been detached from me. There was no guilt that made me feel like I couldn't be human. So I was just who I thought I had to be. And as time went on, I'd use it as a shield because I knew that that was happening, that there was like these social conditioning that was working in my favor, even just the survival part, let alone the criminal justice, me trying to get out.
Now that you've been out for 6 years,
right,
and hearing you talk about it, you're very calm and you paint a picture that is, I think, either you're in a little bit of denial, you know, like they say, denial is not a river in Egypt, right, about how terrifying and how, I know it was a brutal experience, right, no matter all the things you're saying, notwithstanding. But I do want to turn to the happy part of the story,
yeah,
right? Your exoneration,
right,
and then what happened after you got out, because America loves a comeback.
Yeah, man.
And your story is very uplifting. I mean, just the fact that you're here now is got to be inspiring to so many people. So how did you, was it the Northern California Innocence Project that took your case?
Was. I think my exoneration is sort of twofold here, but when it came to the legal components to it, I did what many other people do. They write letters and they bother their families and they have a friend who they can nag about it. They do that. Like, it's a constant scratching away at this, right? And so for me, it was a 15-year letter writing campaign that went nowhere. I mean, it was Oprah and 2020 and 48 hours. And some wrote back, you know, along with Barry Scheck, who wasn't interested in at the time with a case that wasn't involving DNA, which I understood. But as bizarre as this was, I was a Folsom prisoner working as a teacher's aide. So I was, you know, helping the teacher correct papers and do some algebra on the board, whatever, just pretty basic stuff, right? And Tony Carter, who was a teacher, she was about to retire. And there was like this internal policy where you can't get too close to the prisoners because if not, they'll fire you and so on. And so I knew that and I don't want to get her in trouble. So she knew my plight, but I never went as far as to say, hey, Tony, would you help? But now I figure she's done. You know, she's about to retire. Now is the time, right? So on the last moment she's walking away on that Friday, I say, Tony. And she looks back and she says, yeah, what's up? Did you forget to say something? And sure enough, I did, right? I said, would you help me? And she's like, sure. Like, what can I do for you, right? You know my story. If now that you're retired, if you're in your travels in the world, if you come across a lawyer, a reporter, anyone you think might be interested in my story, would you just mind just sharing that with them? And I think anyone would have said yes. It's pretty simple, right? You're about to leave. And so she says, sure, I can do that. And I was really relieved because a letter, I can do that all day long. But face-to-face, it's a different dynamic there. But I felt really happy that I was able to muster the guts to do that. And so turns out that 6 months after that conversation, she was invited to a book club in Sacramento. This guy named Bo Lozoff, who's now has passed, was going to do some book signing, and she had seen him before. And so she shows up, and lo and behold, there's an attorney in the room. And luckily for me, she mentioned that she was a lawyer, because guess who was listening? Tony, who says, oh, shit, I guess this is a calling, right? So she goes over and says, I heard you're a lawyer, and, you know, I have this guy, you know, I used to be a former teacher in prison, and there's a story I want to share with you. And literally, that's what triggered it. This woman was, Ellen Eggers, was a public defender working on death penalty cases in California, who then got in touch with Northern California Innocence Project, Morrison and Forster, and this dream came together. It took them 5 years, and it could have taken them 10 years. I didn't care. But finally, someone was going beyond the record and saying, let's listen to what this guy has to say. So they turned stones over that had been ignored. They tracked down these six boys, these now men, they weren't kids anymore. And one by one, it was almost like if they were being freed from their own miseries. They all, from what I hear, they were all so gracious to say, like, you know what, thank you for finding me. I need to tell you the truth, as if they were living with this pain as well. There was witnesses that were brought in to clarify how things were described that happened couldn't have happened. And so the evidence that was used against me had gone away. And there was a final hearing. Luckily for me, the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office conceded the case. So there was ultimately no fight. They agreed that this had gone wrong, and I was free to go. And so the words I've been yearning to hear all my life, well, seemed to be my entire life, the judge said them, which is basically, get out of here.
Did he apologize?
The DA's apologized in the room, which felt really good. They came over and shook my hand. I think the judge, he gave more of like a philosophical response to that, but it was less about him. It was more about the DA's office. And it turned out that the culprit, the bad players here, were just as bad cop. I'm a big fan of law enforcement, but in this situation, it was a bad cop who was tied up with his internal gang situation, and shit went bad, and I had to suffer.
Yes, you certainly did. So you walked out of the courthouse. You walked in. Well, you were arrested. You didn't walk in. You were taken in as a 16-year-old boy. You walk out as a 37-year-old man. Yeah. What's that like? You walk out. I mean, what is freedom taste? And then your dad had died in the interim, right? So now you're an orphan.
Yep.
And you walk out into what? What'd you do? Yeah. Did you go get something to eat? Like, what'd you do? Did you hug a tree?
No.
I mean,
I wish I would have been released from the courtroom. I was released from the sheriff's department's jail there, the county jail, LA County Jail. And it was about, it was midweek. It was about maybe 2 p.m. And they called me out of my cell and took me down to the street level and doors open, and there was like a TMZ moment, really. All these cameras bouncing on their shoulders trying to interview me, right? And all the mics come out before my family and lawyers could get to me. And how does it feel to be free? How does it feel to be free, right? And the big question. And I think I ignored that one because I sort of thought about that for a very long time when I was in prison. What's it going to feel like? And it sort of felt stupid to say it feels great or whatever. So, but I remember thinking that it was such a bright day. The colors that were just at my disposal now, it seemed to be like a sensory overload, which is my immediate reaction was, whoa, the wind, the colors, the people, the attention. Because, you know, Jason, the reality was that at a very young age, I had become like the man in the iron mask, where my voice was taken away. My existence, before I had a chance to even blossom, was extinguished. There was no chance for this young life to become anything. And so I had to live with that. I had to live with the fact that when I did try to make an attempt to speak up for myself, that was ignored and I was minimized. So that was a personal struggle that all kind of came together the day I was out. So from no attention to like, hey, we're all here for you, right? Which was great. My attorneys were there. My family was there. Some who I hadn't seen in a very long time.
And so you know, what happened? So then you're out.
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
You know, I was ushered into a car pretty quickly and we went to Echo Park to a friend's home who they had a good Whole Food sort of spread waiting for me, right? So I went from cafeteria food for 20 years or prison food, which is even worse, to this long table of organic almonds and dried apricots, you know, so that was pretty cool.
Almonds and apricots.
Something you find like in La Jolla, man.
It sounds a little biblical. You know what I mean? It's kind of funny.
That's right.
I was thinking you were going to say you got like a sandwiches and, you know, I was picturing more of a, you know, I mean, if they had almonds and apricots, I would have actually been pissed. I would have been like, come on, really? Like,
right.
Can I get a slice?
A little
pizza, something? I mean, come on, man. So then you went home and then, you know, now here it is. You've rebuilt your life.
Yep.
You've successfully filed a lawsuit. Well, you had two lawsuits, right? And one was settled.
Yep.
And the other one you won, right? So you're now, unlike many of our exonerees, there's a bright spot there because, you know, I talk about it often, but the fact is, you know, so many exonerees, and it's something we're working to fix, do not receive compensation. You were able to prove violations of your civil rights and other things that led to you being compensated in a meaningful way that's going to now allow you to help fix this system. That would be a great full circle, wouldn't it? You know?
I can't wait. And I'm not minimizing the money here because it makes my life very enjoyable. I think the true joyous moments for me since I've been home is that before I even got out, and this is I hope that can be sort of passed along to those who are in prison, rightly or wrongly, but this idea that you have to, before you even get out, you can't sort of prepare yourself the night before, like, okay, tomorrow is my big release date, let me kind of get my thoughts together. This has to happen long before the door opens. And so I feel that, in sort of credit to myself and those who were around me, that my transition phase happened long before the door opened. And so when the door opened, I felt very prepared to just attempt to just now really be free, because a common theme was when you got there, some older guy kind of gave you some like advice. As an example, you have 5 years to do. And the advice was, for the first 4 years, just kind of hang out, man. You know, you're in prison, just relax, just play some cards and shit. And if, you know, you want to play dominoes, go work out, right? But the last year, man, like the last year, like, you know, go to church, or if you're smoking, stop smoking, get it together, right? And I thought that was pretty good advice. Shit, why not, man? What else you got to lose, right? And at some point, I realized that even though I was a lifer, that advice applied to me. And it was against suspending complete reality here, but it was like, you know what? I'm making all these efforts to try to get my case heard and try to get some attention here. Let me work on me too. Let me work on this idea that I need to prepare myself. And so fast forward, I went a month after I got out with some good friends, Scott Wood, and who I ended up living with in Manhattan Beach, and his wife, Jeannie Wood. I enrolled at a great university in Los Angeles, Loyola Marymount University. So it went from, and I'm sort of funny here, but I went from one prison to another because it had all the elements that I needed. And it felt like for a guy like me, I needed the structure that I had been accustomed to. And it's not a put down, but it was the university gave me the camaraderie, the friendship. There was no barbed wire, but shit, I had deadlines, man. I had to show up, you know? And so it went from a very negative environment that I was into a very, very loving and encouraging space, which was the school, right? Along with just sort of being active and being in activism, how could I not support the Innocence Project and ways to end the death penalty in California and other social issues around the state? But
right, and that's just gotten a whole lot worse with the speed up the death penalty referendum that passed in California, which is absolutely unimaginable and unconscionable that people would have voted for that because they voted for guaranteeing that we're going to execute a lot of innocent people because the changes to the law are devastating to people who have claims of innocence. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's to speed up the death penalty.
Yep.
None of it makes any sense. But voices like yours and all the exposure that is the media is really driving interest in this issue of innocence, this issue of mass incarceration and other related criminal justice problems that are sadly uniquely American problems because other countries are so much more evolved than we are. You know, it's incredible, Frankie. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. The point I'm making is that when we process people at this rate, where we just keep feeding this prison industrial complex, there are going to be mistakes. There are going to be more Frankie Carrillos. We have to reverse the entire way of thinking that we have and start to become a more progressive society in terms of the way we treat the people who are really the least among us, people who find themselves in the situation that you are in, not a wealthy person by any means, and then just being ground up by the system. Right. I want to get to last words because I always like to give our guests the opportunity to air anything that you can think of that you want to share with our audience. You've been through so much. You've come through sounding, looking, feeling, acting like a person who knows stuff. You have such a calm demeanor and such a positive outlook. It's almost unnerving, to be honest with you. You know, I mean, for a minute there, you were making prison sound like it was like, yeah, you know, whatever, this many years, that man, like, I'm, you know, yeah. Like, it's just...
You know, thank you, Jason, for these final words here. That I think that for many people listening, and people even in my life now think, you know, like, this dude, you know, this optimism stuff, is he's taking it to a different level here, right? And, you know, I wish that I can sort of either write a book or explain how I made it through and how these things weren't able to penetrate my armor here, but I suffer. I can't minimize that. There are things and moments where I might hear a song that might trigger true sadness about what I'd experienced as a whole, about the things that were lost, about, you know, all the what ifs, right? And very quickly, I made it a point to remember what anger and what revenge and what hatred does to someone. Tell you even deeper here that when I was in prison, I think about those who had owned that, who had owned the anger and the revenge and the hatred. And I saw these men that were being blinded by it. And I don't want to be that. And here we are in a room full of statues, this beautiful art that predates all of us here. And I think about if that was who I'd become in prison, I wouldn't be here, one. And two, if I had traces of that and I was out, on some level, I would still be on the inside. I would be physically free, but the rage that would be living within me would be like a prison all to itself. And so, I mean, I'm happy that I can make those connections in my own existence for my own personal healing and as I move forward in my life. And speaking of that life, I'm happily married. I have three amazing children. I have Theo, Akiva, and Frida. My wife, FD, is amazing. And life is great. And I think it's a responsibility for not only myself and my family, to take on this responsibility of giving people the pleasure of experiencing a cognitive dissonance, which is you are around or you hear and you experience something, it suspends you from and it shocks you into like, this is not what I expected from a guy who'd been in prison for all these years. And it challenges you, your own beliefs, your own things you've been carrying with you. The psychological moment says, wow, like I need to change what I used to think about those who were on the inside. And so it's a responsibility for me and other exonerees, I feel, that to awaken that side of all of us to say, let's not do that. Let's not do that to each other. And we, when someone says it's not a joke anymore that they are innocent, let's listen. Because we know many experiences and many stories that are tragic that we've been listening to this whole weekend of if only someone really listened and cared.
Yeah, and everybody out there has the power to make a difference. I always encourage our audience to get involved, and it's great to see that many of them are. I know in hearing your story, for me, again, it puts gratitude in my attitude. It makes all those little wham-whams that we all have in life just seem so much easier to deal with and so much just surface noise, right? When somebody like you can come and have this sort of aura, and it's amazing, Frankie, you know, the fact is, to any of us in the movement and to other people on the outside, it's a source of never-ending wonder and awe that every single exoneree I've ever met has some version of that type of higher consciousness that you've managed to achieve. They have this state of, almost like a state of grace that is, it's just inspiring. That's all it is. And so I appreciate you taking the time to share your experience, strength, and hope with us. And again, I'm just going to have to take a moment to process this, and then I'm going to go and get busy and get back to work on helping others.
That's right.
We've had a very unique experience because we've been recording the podcast in an idyllic environment. We're actually in a room in a home overlooking the Pacific Ocean on a cliff surrounded by the most incredible African art. So I want to thank our hosts, Bill LaRock and Michelle Ciccarelli LaRock, for having us here and allowing us to record in their beautiful home. Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.